So, reminds me that my son, for some time now, but it happened again this morning, will ask some version of, is that real? And for some reason today it was about Santa Claus, and about Santa Claus coming down the chimney, and it had to be about why we hang stockings in front of the fireplace, and we don't have a fireplace, so why do we hang stockings, and where did that come from, and is Santa Claus real? And Mommy's told me he's not real. And I was going to be non-committal about it. And but Mommy says he's not real. Well, yeah. But he's kind of real in some ways. And so what's real? And there's a lot of discussion these days about the new Matrix movie. And one of the aspects about the Matrix movie, the original one at least, is a question of what's real. And how do we find out what's real? And this is, I think, is a theme that has runs through much of modern life in various places. It pops up. What is real? How can we know what is real? The you can go into almost any field of study these days, scientific study and humanities, and find people who are taking things apart. Deconstructionists, for example, and what we thought was real turns out not to be so real. And one of the very fascinating aspects of this kind of deconstruction, for Buddhists at least, has to do with a scientific deconstruction of the sense of self. And it turns out not only Buddhists aren't the only people who argue about not-self or non-self, but modern psychologists and sociologists and anthropologists all kind of show how the notion of self, biologists, all kind of, you know, how it arises, how it's constructed, and how it's, you know, has to do with certain activities of the brain. And So they don't leave us with much. What's real? And then psychologists have pointed out memories are not reliable. That the memories get, revised in the retelling. So we go and tell someone, you did X, Y, and Z to me, and well, maybe you did, and maybe in the retelling it gets a little bit changed, likely, maybe not a lot. There's the whole idea of what is real, what is not real. And some months ago, I got an email from a man I never met, who asked me a question. He wanted to ask me as the Buddhist authority, what is real? What do you know is real? How do you know what's real? And my reply to him, I suspected, was unsatisfactory, because he didn't, there was no more correspondence.
He was completely
satisfied. Oh, yeah, maybe. And my response to him was that in Buddhism, we're not particularly interested in that question, what is real. That's not really in the kind of domain of what Buddhism is about. But rather, because you can get lost endlessly in the discussion of what's real and what's not real. And what Buddhism focuses on is something much more particular, and that is our suffering and the possibility of freedom from suffering, liberation from suffering. And it was, I think it was an inadequate question. The Buddhists do focus on knowing what's real. And part of what I want to do today is to give the more Buddhist response to what Buddhism says, at least, about what is real and how you can know what's real. And in order to do this, I want to start off by referring to the Kalama Sutta. This is a very famous discourse of the Buddha. It's possible it became much more famous and important in the modern West than it ever had in Asia. And partly because in the West we have a very strong legacy, a very strong movement of wanting to be free thinkers, of wanting to be independent, especially now in the kind of coming into the more modern times. Spiritual circles, religious circles, people want to be spiritual, which has to do a lot about one's own inner spiritual life, one's own inner qualities, and very little to do with externals and what you believe, but more what happens within you, whether there's love or peace or compassion or these beautiful qualities that we can have. And so the idea of the individual knowing for him or herself what the path is, finding one's own path, finding the truth for oneself, And, you know, it certainly has a legacy or background in the West, for example, in the Protestant movement, where you're supposed to have your personal relationship with God directly. And so it kind of jumped over or wiped out a certain class of religious people that no longer were going to mediate between you and God. It was personal. You find it for yourself. So because of that strong tendency in the West, this particular discourse has been held up as kind of like the great manifesto of free thinking. And so it's a very interesting text, and it's interesting to look at it more carefully than sometimes it's done. Sometimes you find it quoted, just one or two lines from it. Someone once sent me a postcard where one line from this was misquoted. And it said, the postcard said something like, I don't remember exactly, but I remember being misquoted. Should I misquote the misquote? Yeah, how do you know it's real? And Yvonne Rand, who's a wonderful Zen teacher here in the Bay Area, she came here a few weeks ago, I think, a couple of months ago. She once said that this sutra is so important that all Buddhists should have it tattooed to the inside of their eyelids. So I don't recommend to go that extremes, but once in a while, it's nice to teach about it. So the story concerns a group of people called the Kalamas, and they lived in a town or place called Kesaputta. And the Kalamas apparently had a lot of spiritual teachers of different kinds come through their town. And seemingly, the different teachers said, you know, this is the truth. Listen to me, follow my way, and this is the ultimate teaching. And they noticed that there were a lot of these teachers came through, and they had different teachings. And they all said, this is true. So how do you know what's real? How do you know what's true? Well, the Buddha happened to come through this town. And maybe we can imagine that, you know, they said, oh, here comes one more of those guys. Or gals, you know. Here comes one more. Going to tell us what the truth is. So they decided that they would take a different approach. So they asked, they went to the Buddha and said, there are all these people that come here to this village. And they all tell us this is what's true. And not only that, but they revile and criticize the doctrines of other people. So how can we know what's true? So that's a great question. How can we know? How can we know which of these venerable teachers are speaking the truth and which ones are lying? So they're not asking the Buddha directly for, you know, what is his teaching, but rather, how can you find your way to the truth? And so the Buddha's response, and this is the kind of the paragraph which is much quoted. The first thing the Buddha says is, of course you are uncertain, Kalamas. Of course you are in doubt. And that's very nice, kind of affirming. Of course you should be confused. How many of you are confused? That's a poor showing of hands. The people who come here the most are the ones who raise their hands. Should I be worried? When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty is born. So in this case, Kalamas, so here comes a real climax of this paragraph. In this case, Kalamas, don't go by, don't rely on reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logic, by inference, by analogy, by agreement with your views, by probability, or by the thought, this person is my teacher. What's left? And what's often pointed out is some of these sources of authority for the truth are quite commonly used in religious circles and other places also. Certainly, you know, it says don't go by scripture. There goes the Bible out the window. Or Buddhist Bibles. It's, you know, this is a scripture, so I guess, you know, so it's a little bit of a paradox. We should start reading it, stop reading it. Don't go by it just because it's traditional. It's been, you know, it's handed down from your parents and your parents' parents and your society. By you're using your own logic. The Buddha says somehow your own logic, your power of mental reasoning things out, it might not be the most reliable way of finding out what's true or authoritative. And don't do it by agreement with your own views. That's quite common, of course. You know, we have our own views already, and then someone says something, and we measure it against our views. And if it's similar to our views, then we say it's true. Or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. This person is our teacher. So that's the criticism. And some people will stop right there in quoting this passage. Just don't do any of these things. So it's a very radical stance. Kind of pulls the rug from under some of the major sources of authority that upon which society is built. And it could be seen as being very subversive and offering, you know, challenging the status quo in many different ways, because the very authority upon which the status quo is based is challenged. And said, don't go by that. How many of us are brave enough to stand free of any of these sources of authority? Then the Buddha offered this. When you know for yourselves that these qualities, these mental qualities, these dhammas is the word, but these mental qualities, these mental attributes, these mental characteristics, these mental activities, are unskillful. These qualities are blameworthy. These qualities are criticized by the wise. These qualities, when undertaken and carried out, lead to harm and to suffering. Then you should abandon them. And then he goes on, says a few other things, and then he says the same thing over again, but in a different way. He says, when you know for yourself that these qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when undertaken and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness, then you should enter and remain in them. And some people translate this as being when you know for yourself, then you know what the truth is. And so it's probably the misquote of the misquote. When you know for know for yourself. And there is an emphasis on this, but if you naively say know for yourself, I mean, without any kind of analysis or kind of critique of why do you know what you know? What is the basis upon which you know something? There's a lot of people who have intuitive knowing. Is your intuition reliable? I have a lot of intuition. I feel my intuition has increased dramatically through my meditation practice, my Dharma practice. And I rely on my intuition a lot. But my intuition, I don't feel, is 100% reliable. So when I feel a strong intuitive sense of something, I'm very cautious about it in certain settings. And I'll look at it and wait for a little while and see if it does make sense, and kind of I don't just go automatically because it seems intuitively right. And I've saved myself trouble because of kind of waiting a little bit and having a little bit of benefit, a little bit of doubt there before I go ahead with my intuition or my logic. Lots of times where I think I know something because I've reasoned it out in a certain way, and then found out someone else comes along and has a better reasoning or has a better understanding of what was going on. And I realized that my reasoning wasn't so right. And I go to a lot of meetings, for me at least, much more than I ever thought a Buddhist teacher would have to go to. And I often have ideas of how things should be, and sometimes I offer them, but I always offer them, or try to offer them, at least inside myself, in the spirit that I don't really know and I'm waiting to hear, and I'm offering them in the spirit of dialogue, waiting to hear what someone else says in reply. And maybe someone else has a better understanding or a better view or will explain something that's missing. So it isn't just simply a matter of naively knowing for yourself. You have to analyze why you know what you know or how you know. How do you know what's real? And I apologize for repeating what I'm going to say. I've repeated it so many times, but I'm still tickled by this little story of there was a study done in the 80s of children in New York City who had near-death experiences. And a very high percentage of those kids had some of the classic experiences, near-death experiences of white tunnel, white light, and these things. And by the end of the tunnel, the high percentage of them had the Ninja Turtles. So that's interesting, I think. what's true? How do we know what's real? When you have the Buddha at the end of your tunnel, is it now you know for a fact you've met the Buddha, you know he's real, and you know you have no doubts anymore. Isn't that Buddha maybe the same kind of projection as the Ninja Turtles is for the children? Who knows? But it certainly raises the question: how do we know what's true? And I find myself quite disturbed by an expression. Maybe it's kind of a New Age expression that I hear around sometimes. People say, "This is my truth." And the reason that I'm disturbed by it is that, I think half of it is they're pointing to something very important and very useful. And the other half is a naive, by saying it's my truth, it's kind of validating beyond its what's warranted. The half that's useful is that people are trying to rely on how they experience things and how they see things. And they're stating it. This is how I see things, this is how I understand things, this has been my experience. But then by saying it's my truth, it kind of solidifies it. And it kind of gives it a kind of absolute authority where, that's your truth and this is my truth and we're not going to meet, we're not going to negotiate, we're not going to just be in dialogue about it. And it seems a little bit hard to me, that approach. If you say, this is my experience, then it's quite comfortable, a statement. My experience is, I perceive things this way. How do you perceive things? So the Buddha says, these qualities, the word qualities means dhammas, it translates dhammas or dharmas, which here is understood as being these mental qualities or mental activities, mental factors of the mind. And when these qualities are unskillful, and this is a really key word in the Buddha's vocabulary, the word unskillful and skillful. I prefer to translate it as helpful and unhelpful. When you realize for yourself that having these qualities in my mind, having this color in my mind, having these emotional qualities, intentions in my mind, this activity in my mind present, when I realize that it's helpful or it's unhelpful, then they are to be abandoned. When I realize they're helpful, then they are to be held onto or kept, to abide in those. The Buddha also says, when these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise. Most of the people who use this paragraph as a championing free thinking and we can rely on our own self, conveniently leave out the section that says, these qualities are criticized by the wise. Because, of course, we shouldn't be concerned about what other people think. But here the Buddha says, you should have some concern about what the wise people around you think. And you probably have some sense of who the wise people are, who's wise in your life, who's wiser than you, perhaps. And if they criticize certain qualities, or if they praise certain qualities, then I don't think we're supposed to take them, naively as offering the truth. But they offer kind of guidance. Oh, if they say that, maybe I should look at this more carefully. Maybe I should explore this. Maybe I should hold off and not get into trouble. So some kind of guidance. And I think having some kind of guidance is very important because There's an infinite. It's so difficult to find our way in this complicated life that we live, that to be given some guidance can solve a lot of problems. Can prevent a lot of problems arising. So, you know, the wise say you shouldn't go around killing or stealing or lying or involved in sexual misconduct. And you'll solve a lot of problems for yourself or prevent a lot of problems if you avoid doing those things. So it's getting a little bit of guidance. But the key thing is the first one. These qualities are unskillful. So the Buddha is pointing the attention back at the quality the quality of our own mind, the quality of our own hearts. What are the qualities that reside there? He's not talking about the activity here, and he's not talking about beliefs or creeds. And he's not, you know, he's not exactly coming back and saying this is the truth. What he's saying is you should know what, you know, some ultimate sense, but, you know, this is how you know what's true. In some ultimate way, he's pointing to a process that moves a person from suffering to freedom from suffering, from being under stress to being freed from stress, from being oppressed to being freed from oppression, from being caught up in the mind, consumed by greed, hate, and delusion in the mind, to being free of those and having a mind filled with the opposites. So the qualities of the mind is what we need to study and become aware of. And that's one of the reasons why we practice mindfulness, is so we can recognize and see where the quality of our own mind is. And then take that into account. And if they are unhelpful qualities of mind, then find some way to work with those, to be involved in a process with those, so they can be abandoned, be let go of, or so they cannot get in our way or keep us enslaved or imprisoned. The focus on the unskillful and the skillful, the unhelpful and the helpful, by learning how to study ourselves, know ourselves that way, is the way in which we find the path. If you want to find the Buddhist path, these are the guidelines for how you find it. You find it for yourself by knowing what is it in your own mind, your own heart, that keeps it in suffering, and what is it that gets it free of suffering. Now, it's very easy to say that. It's not so easy necessarily to abandon the unskillful qualities of mind. So then there's a whole path of practice that involves, you know, different practices, different understandings, different levels of acceptance and forgiveness and compassion and all kinds of things that come into play that involve massaging that unskillful qualities of the heart so we can eventually let go of them or be free of them. It turns out that in later Buddhism, some centuries after the Buddha, when people were systematizing the Buddha's teachings, they did come up with a list of the four ultimate things, the four things you can really know that are real, for being really real. And one of those four is this thing, your own mental qualities. Another one is what's called the four great elements, earth, water, fire, and air. And what's interesting about these four great elements is that they're not a form of early physics. They weren't meant to be kind of physical description of the world. They were meant as a way of categorizing the sensations we experience in our body. Because much of the way we experience the world, everywhere we experience the world, is through the filter, the avenue, the channel of our senses. And so these four elements are our experience at the level of sensation. Before there's interpretation, before there's categories on top of it, but just immediate level of sensation. So for example, if you're feeling hot or you're feeling cold, then you're feeling the fire element. If you're feeling great solidity or softness in your body or hardness in your body, it's the earth element. If you're feeling movement in your body of some kind, then it's the air element. So it's a way of categorizing the ways in which we categorize the sensations we feel. And why this is interesting is one of the ultimates, one of the things that we really know that's real, is that it's this, our sensation level of our experience, we can show us sometimes that we're suffering or that we're free of suffering. To have a cue, to have some kind of cue, some kind of wake-up signal that says, oh, I need to stop and pay attention to what's going on now for me, is really helpful. And having your physical body as that mindfulness bell, as that cue, is phenomenally useful as you go about your life. And to develop a capacity to be in your body, to check in with your body in a very regular way, find out what's going on in this body of yours. And you'll find there's a tremendous amount of information, some people would say wisdom, that resides in your body. Because so much of our suffering has a physical component element. Sometimes we suffer and you don't have to know that you have physical suffering as part of it. You know, tension or tightness or something. It's just so blatantly obvious that we're suffering, we're depressed or something. But sometimes we're busy with life, we're preoccupied, and we're searching for the truth so actively we don't even notice what's here in the present moment. And we might not notice that our stomach is tight, our shoulders are tight. But if you check in a situation normally where you wouldn't check in, you might think, oh, my stomach is tight. Why is that? And then you might notice you're a little bit afraid or nervous. And it might not be enough nervousness to make you kind of stop what you're doing or even normally pay attention. But having noticed it gives you a chance then to turn back and try to liberate that nervousness, to do something about it. So the subtle sufferings and also gross sufferings, some best ways to learn about it is through the body. One of the very useful ways of being present for it is also through the body. To feel our embodied experience is to feel things in much more rawly and directly, free of the story making we make about anything. So say that you're angry with someone. It's very easy to go into story making around that anger. Who did what to who, and what you're going to say in reply, and it's whole, you know, a whole world of story making about it. And it might have no basis in fact at all. I've been angry with people when I found out later I had no reason to be angry, when I found out more what was really going on. But I kind of jumped to conclusions. So my fantasy, my anger was completely based on projection and fantasy. And I've had other kinds of angers too where I had good cause. But there's all kinds, right? But you know, it's so easy to get lost in the story making. And actually, to have good cause to be angry, and to be caught up in story making, it's like adding a match to gasoline. It's very dangerous. So one of the things that mindfulness practice teaches then is to learn to drop down into the body and experience the anger in the body, in the physical aspect of anger, for various reasons. One reason so that it interrupts the story-making processes and we can connect with the anger more directly and rawly. There are times when the story-making aspect of the anger might be very important to look at and work with. But it's also a very important tool to have, knowing when to drop that and just to be with experience directly for itself. Also, the body is a wonderful... body is a process. And in being a process, and the mind, when it's preoccupied, tends to lock or freeze the process. If you can stop the story making and drop down into the body and hang out with what's going on in the body, it tends to liberate the process that the body is. And so often the body will, if you're present for your bodily experience, will also often facilitate the healing or the liberation or the loosening that can happen if you just get out of your own way, if you stay present for what's going on. So these two ultimates, these two things you can know for are real, is the qualities of your mind and what is going on at the sensation level of your body. I don't feel a need to call these what's real, as if that's going to validate it. What I would say is that all you need to know in order to follow the path to liberation is that how you're suffering, the qualities of the mind that support and cause the suffering, and how you can be free of suffering and the qualities of the mind that lead to that. I don't know if we need to say any more about whether those are real or not. Maybe that's very unsatisfying, and maybe I'm not a good philosopher or something. But for, I think the Buddha was pointing to is not what's ultimately real, as if that was really important. Who knows what that is? Is it necessary to know what that is? Maybe it is. But what the Buddha was pointing to is knowing how to find the path to liberation, the path to how you can become free. The fourth of these ultimates that the later tradition said you can know is ultimately real is nirvana, or it's called nibbana in our tradition. And this would be the mind or the consciousness that is liberated or freed or become completely independent from any of the conditions of the world. Normally our mind, our consciousness, is very much colored and tainted and influenced by all the mental qualities, these mental factors that are playing itself out, and how we, you know, and through them how we relate to the world. And so the awareness and consciousness is always about something, engaged in something. So it's like our presence is always being pulled and pushed by the world around us and the world inside of us. But when our presence can be at peace, at ease, set free from any of the conditions that we tend to be pushed and pulled against or with, when our presence can just abide peacefully in its own right, self-supporting, self-floating, perhaps, I don't know what the right language is. When you really know, you can really know for yourself when your presence, when your consciousness, when your mind has that freedom and that peace where it's completely independent and freed from all the conditions of the world. That's not a rejection from being involved with the conditions of the world. It just means that you're not going to be caught by them. You're going to be able to go through the world and be free. So how do we know what's real? Do we need to know what's real? From the point of view of the Buddhist path, we only need to know what's where the suffering is and where the freedom from suffering is. And it's probably a very, you know, in terms of, you know, in some ways it's probably philosophically very unsatisfying. Because it'd be nice to have a philosophy that was grand and offered a, you know, a great unifying principle of the spiritual universe. But what Buddhism does in the end is really offer you on a silver platter a mirror for you to look down into your own hearts. And by having that mirror, learning how to tend lovingly, compassionately to what you find in your own hearts. And then slowly learning to transform that heart to one that's at peace. And as I said this weekend, to paraphrase myself, to misquote myself from the weekend, to be at peace and to be a person who never again needs to complain about the world. So those are my thoughts about what's real. And it says here, do not believe a person just because he's your teacher. Or if it's in the scriptures. Or if it just makes sense. You have to put it into practice, test it for yourself. Find out through your own testing of this whether this is something that's useful for you and helpful. So those are my thoughts, and now it's your turn. We have about 5 minutes. Yes?
I want to simply say that the very question of what is real is false, not useful.
Not useful?
What's
a more useful question?
How does one attain peace?
Perfect. You understood. You summarized the talk in two sentences. beautiful. Thank you. And I'd prefer to add something to what you said, for the danger, all the dangers that involves adding. And that is, what is it that you said something like, what is it that brings peace to oneself? And I would add, and to others. So there's not just simply, you know, self-absorbed process. It's in a process that in some ways includes everyone. We're in it together. And yes, Adam.
How would we know that it seems like as we just stated, I mean, instead of asking for reality, we say, you know, what brings us, say, more or less fear, greed, delusion. And I imagine someone could say, well, all right, so that seems like the question that we've chosen. It does seem relevant to me. That would be agreeing with my view, that it seems like a really relevant question. But how do we... It does seem like the fact that we chose that question, that the Buddha chose that question, is... you could conceivably choose some other question. One could conceivably choose some other question. And how do you know which is the right question?
How do you know which is the right question? If you want to get to Los Angeles, you have to ask the right question. If you ask, you know, what's the way to Boston, or, you know, what's the weather like in the Sierras, you know, that's not going to help you get to Los Angeles. So you have to know what you want. And so if you want freedom, then you have to know what's the useful questions for this. One of the inspirations for this talk was that someone came to me recently and said, I'll misquote the person. My memory doesn't work so well. But it was something like, very roughly, he said, you know, that he uses some of the Buddhist teachings to understand his experience. So, you know, which Buddhist... and he said, oh, things like impermanence and not-self and, you know, things like that. And I said, oh, those aren't meant to be teachings to apply to our experience that way. Those are supposed to be realizations. But not ideas that we try to understand our experience. If you want to find the path, if you want to ask the right question, what the Buddha said was, you formulate your questions about life from the point of view of the Four Noble Truths. And so the Four Noble Truths, which is the framework for understanding your experience, that helps you find the path. And that's another way of talking about what I talked about today, I think. So you have to know what the right questions are. And in order to know what the right questions are, you also have to know what you want. And there is a kind of a catch-22. And so if you've met someone, for example, who offers or exemplifies a path to liberation and freedom, there has to be a little bit of giving them, you have to have some confidence in them that what they're saying might be worth testing and finding out for yourself. But you don't really know for sure until you've done it for yourself. The beauty about this process, though, is that it's verifiable in small steps. You don't have to be fully enlightened to find out this process of studying through the Four Noble Truths, or monitoring the qualities of your mind and abandoning the unhelpful and abiding in the helpful ones is helpful for you. I mean, you'll learn very quickly if that works. That was a good question, Adam. I think my answer was inadequate as a reply. But so be it. Other comments, questions? Yes?
I've been thinking about, how do we know when we're deluded?
How do you know when you're deluded? Well, it helps when you have good friends. You can make kind of, you know, suggestions. You know, I think you need to, let's look at this together. And And certainly we know we're deluded. We can know a little bit about delusion through our past experience. You can also know when you're deluded when you very clearly can see how the mind is fabricating and constructing the delusion. You know, you've probably seen your mind construct a fantasy, and you know it was a fantasy. Well, when the mind is very attentive, you'll see how any kind of thought that arises is a thought. And so by seeing it as a thought, it kind of removes ourselves a little bit from the thought, and we can see it a little more as a supposition, as a possibility. And then it's easier to see it as an interpretation or as a delusion. So that's one way. It requires a lot of mindfulness to really be able to kind of step outside, in a sense, of our thinking and see it for what it is as it arises. And some people define an enlightened person or a mature practice as not being free of delusion, but rather being able to really see clearly delusion when it arises, so you're not caught by it. So that's my best answer. I don't have a good answer for you for that. And you have to find out for yourself. One of the things I thought of doing today was, because I was talking about these mental qualities that we're supposed to study and become familiar with, at the risk of some risk, I guess, the later Buddhist tradition, after the time of the Buddha, a few centuries after, when they tried to formulate and systematize the teachings of the Buddha, they came up with a list of different Buddhist traditions came up with different lists, but the Theravadin tradition came up with a list of 52 mental qualities. You only have 52. Right. Very convenient. And so I thought I would just read them. And as a kind of liturgy. Contact, feeling tone, perception, volition, concentration, vitality, attention, initial application of attention, sustained application of attention, determination, energy, effort, joy, zeal, ignorance, shamelessness, restlessness, attachment, wrong view, conceit, aversion, envy, stinginess, regret, sloth, torpor, doubt, confidence, mindfulness, conscience, and regret, a healthy regret for what we've done that's bad, it's unhelpful. Non-attachment, non-aversion, equanimity, tranquility of body, tranquility of mind, lightness of body, lightness of mind, pliancy of body, pliancy of mind, wieldness of body, wieldness of mind, uprightness of body, uprightness of mind, compassion, sympathetic joy, and insight. So what's beautiful about these are all qualities of your mind, which are like capacities that you all have. And so the question is, which of these capacities do you support and develop? And which of these capacities do you abandon and let wither up so that they don't trouble you anymore? So, so may all of you know for yourself.